and various other organizations. So, and that's the primary focus of what we've wanted to do throughout time, is to have a space where people can come, organize, build the kind of community power we need to win the kinds of things poor and working class people need. Jeff, I'm not going to give a lengthy bio because bios are for little egos, but there's a, you know, he's a nationally renowned author. He's done some amazing work. He's written many books. He's from Appalachia, understands these issues on a very deep level, and writes about those issues in a very personal way. And he's been all over the country, has worked with communities that are on the front lines, dealing with environmental injustice, racial injustice, economic injustice. And so it's a real pleasure to have him here today to talk about his latest book. Just last weekend, in conjunction with the Beyond Coal campaign, Jeff was part of the Ecopolis performance that took place at the Progressive Community Church. For those of you who were able to see it, it was amazing. Thanks to Corey for not only being instrumental in setting up that event, but also being instrumental in having Jeff back here. Corey made the connection with Jeff. He's the reason why Jeff is in this space. So thank you, Corey. And yeah, I'll just turn it over. Anyone who wants more information, if you'd like to be added to our email list, I don't blow up your email once a month or twice a month. Big events, we send out a monthly newsletter. Here's what's happening. Here's how you can get engaged. So otherwise, welcome to the space and welcome, Jeff.
It's not even dark yet. What are you guys doing here? You should all be down eating on Franklin Street. With the beach. I don't know who in the right mind would be inside on a beautiful day like today. But I appreciate you coming, and it's a great crowd. And everyone, give a big hand to Vince and Sergio for just pulling together this incredible festival. Is anybody here for the first time? All right.
Can you use the mic?
Can I use the mic?
All right. Alrighty, these cranky guys telling us what to do. I'm going to resist. This microphone goes to this wire, and this wire goes to the wall, and the wall, there's some little Tinkerbell, like a electricity fairy going behind, and I'm thinking, I don't want to use the microphone. Because there isn't Tinkerbell, of course, it's going to a coal fire plant that's generating electricity that's bringing down my community. And therefore, I would resist, but the cranky guy in the back wants me to use it. So. I'm going to begin reading something from today's headlines, and then we're going to take a little bit of a historical journey, and then I'm going to have two people read with me. Because I want them to help us kind of visualize these figures from history that we often don't talk about. And that's really been my role. I'm kind of a cultural historian of the resistance. This is my eighth book, and my whole career has been about how do I go and collect stories of communities that have not been included in our historical memory and our experience. How do we re-people? When we have to restore our communities, I come from Southern Illinois in the coal fields that was devastated. How do we begin not only to restore our community, but restore it? Because we've been left out. I learned that as a kid when we looked at the history books, realizing, you know, our family was not included. Our 200 years in Southern Illinois as coal miners, of people then who were erased from strip mining, of my grandfather and my family losing their lives to black lung and to coal mining accidents. And so the idea is, how do I begin to collect these stories of the American experience to say, if we're going to talk about we the people, if we're going to talk about who we are today, our quintessential historical moments, we have to include people who've been left out. And that's really what I've been about for all these years. So I've reached the age where I can't read with or without my glasses. So I'm sure some of you understand that. And this comes from a book called Resistance, which is on sale for $24.99. Let them call me rebel and welcome. I feel no concern for it, but I should suffer the misery of devils if I were to make a whore of my soul by swearing allegiance to the one whose character is that of a sottish, stupid, stubborn, worthless, brutish man. That is not about who you think it's about. It was written in a dark moment of American history, a moment like today. And we think today, oh my God, it's dark. I can't wake up in the morning. I can't pick up my iPhone and look at Twitter until I, you know, have a cup of something. And this darkest moment, it's never been so dark as now. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, even in my short lifetime, African Americans couldn't go to my school, that we shrugged at lynching in our communities, that in fact, my grandmother came from a community where even women were not just ostracized, but not included. That I'm wondering, how do we even talk about today being dark when my granddaddy worked 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day, a man 6'4", he was a big man. My mama said, you're just like your granddaddy. He was a big man, except he was like a real man. He had muscles. And my granddaddy working all day in a coal mine that was 4'8". It was called a scratchback mine because they were bent over all day. And we think it has never been darker than today. And I'm wondering, you know, 100 years ago, women couldn't even vote. I'm thinking, how do we even begin to talk about dark times at Standing Rock, realizing that for 500 years, it's been dark times for indigenous people, not just displaced, but wiped out. That the American experience was seated in the darkest times. And this man who wrote this, Thomas Paine, he was an undocumented immigrant. He was the dregs of what we don't want, the kind of immigrants who are failures in their own country. Thomas Paine, this man who had been in debt twice in his life and failed. He twice failed two marriages and left a woman behind. He couldn't even make it as a tax collector in England. And how bad is that? That he gets on a boat and he barely survives the journey because he picks up an illness and they take him off and he's in a stupor and he just happens to have a letter from Benjamin Franklin and they say, oh my God, and of course he didn't even know Benjamin Franklin. He met him at one little meeting and he scribbled off a little note saying good luck. And Thomas Paine had come for the resistance in 1775. This resistance movement he had heard about. And he gets to Philadelphia and he sees that, you know, there's this clash that's going on right now, this complacency, these people who don't want to do much, the colonial elite, people like Benjamin Franklin, who is outraged by people throwing tea into the Boston Tea Party in the Boston Harbor. Benjamin Franklin wrote and said, you know, you really must pay back for that tea. That was not very nice. And yet there are these young cats in Philadelphia, these young immigrants, these young merchants, but mainly it was the black people at the dockyards who were agitating for change, who were confronting the British Empire, who were referred to as mongrels. And Thomas Paine saw this and he realized that there's something afoot, but there's something not working here. There's clearly a movement for resistance, but it's not gelling. And how come we're not recognizing? And so he starts a magazine, because that's what you do when you can't find a job. You start your own magazine. And he started his own magazine, called it the Pennsylvania Magazine. And he begins to publish. And one of the first poems he publishes is by Phyllis Wheatley, this amazing American poet, who said, with every action, let the goddess guide. It is the women who will lead. And she wrote this beautiful poem to George Washington saying, oh, George, you know, you realize why I'm against tyranny and that you should become our leader is because you snatched me from Africa. And George Washington wrote back saying, I will always be your humble servant, not knowing that Phyllis Wheatley was an enslaved American. And of course, she got her freedom because of her fame as a poet. And that's what Paine tried to do. He tried to tell stories. He didn't want to just be a journalist. He didn't just want to go on Twitter. He said, we got to collect stories of people who are part of this resistance, that we have to get over this complacency that we have now, this olive tree declaration. He couldn't believe it because he said, I became an American writer when they shot the Americans at Concord and Lexington. The British troops went in there. And John Hancock, you know, we think of John Hancock with the Declaration of Independence, not realizing that he put his name on it. He put his name on it. Make sure you're talking to the
microphone.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
There's some cranky guy in the back. So.
Watch out for him.
I love Community Radio of Chicago. And I really encourage you to donate when the season comes along for Community Radio. And I lost my thought. And we're in the middle of the revolution. And he couldn't believe the complacency of people like John Hancock. The Americans said, you know, we really are outraged by what you did at Lexington and Concord. How dare you? And we're really mad. Kind of mad. Well, we're not that mad. If it makes you sad, we're not mad. If it pisses you off, we're not going to be that mad. We really kind of want you not to do it anymore, but we love who you are, and we're willing to reconcile. John Hancock, 1775. And Tom Paine was outraged.
The Olive Branch Declaration. We therefore beseech your majesty that your royal authority and influence may be graciously interposed to procure us relief from our afflicting fears and jealousies, that your majesty be pleased to direct some mode by which the united applications of your faithful colonists to the throne in pursuance of their common counsels may be improved into a happy and permanent reconciliation. We beg leave further to assure your majesty that, notwithstanding the sufferings of your loyal colonists during the course of the present controversy, our breasts retain too tender a regard for the kingdom from which we derive our origin to request such a reconciliation that as might in any manner be inconsistent with her dignity or her welfare. These, related as we are to her, honor and duty as well as inclination induce us to support and advance and the apprehensions that now oppress our hearts with unspeakable grief, being once removed, your majesty will find a faithful subject on this continent, ready and willing at all times as they have ever been with their lives and fortunes to assert and maintain the rights and interests of your majesty and our mother country.
Happy reconciliation. Thomas Paine was outraged. The revolution had already begun. Washington was already raising an army. And yet the colonial elite, the Congress, like the Democratic Congress today, didn't have a backbone. They were asking for a happy reconciliation. And so he sat down and he wrote Common Sense, a pamphlet that changed the way we think. We think, you know. It changed the way we write. It changed. He said, I'm going to speak plainly, not what Walter just tried to read. That legalistic terminology. He said, I'm going to tell you the story of who we are. That the time has come. No longer to waste our time with people who don't understand. That if you agree to work with the British, then you are a murderer to me. That he called out people who were fence sitters and people who were part of the colonial elite. He said there's this new movement rising in Philadelphia. There's this new movement that has risen already in Boston, like Crispus Attucks, a young African American who had already challenged the British troops in 1770. This amazing dock worker who couldn't believe how the police were pushing them around and how suddenly they were being brutalized and how the police, of course, were the British officials and they would come in and just arrest people and brutalize them like today. And Crispus Attucks revolted and they clashed and they shot him at the Boston Commons in 1770. And it was amazing because Thomas Paine used this as an example. How could John Adams, our future revolutionary leader, become the defense attorney for the British government? How could John Adams not be part of the resistance? And John Adams, of course, with Crispus, You're on again. Said there's a reason we should be afraid of the resistance.
In front of a government building, soldiers open fire on a crowd killing addicts and four others. Patriot leaders and future President John Adams, in fact, had defended the British at their trial for murder, referring to the American resistors as outlandish and nothing more than a motley rabble. Adams' characterizations of addicts, in fact, provides a compelling insight into the enduring white depiction of black males as inherently dangerous, thereby exonerating any official, police, or military force who shot him down. Adams charged addicts with being a hero of a Myrmidons, a reference to an ancient Greek horde whose very presence in the street was an unlawful assembly. The very looks of this mulatto fellow, Adams justified, was enough to terrify any person. What had not those soldiers then to fear?
And Payne called an ace and said, this is the resistance, just like Boston was. And the funny part about the Boston Tea Party, 3 years later, was the very same John Adams who prosecuted the resistance joined the resistance, saying this was an epical moment in American history, a wonderful moment, that vandalism and violence is now the way to go. It wasn't that John Adams had joined the resistance on his own terms, but he finally realized it was the resistance terms he had to join, and he changed and transformed with the resistance. Payne writes Common Sense in January 10, 1776. It's released. 100,000 copies are distributed. It's read across. Suddenly, George Washington says, this has turned the tide. Our troops are responding. Suddenly, money is pouring into the revolutionary cause. And of course, a few months later, we come out with our July 4th, 1776 declaration. And of course, the war breaks out. The revolution goes on. And we often think, I think, that, you know, July 4th, 1776, we had the revolution. And the next day, we went shopping at the mall, that it was over. And we don't realize that the revolution went on for years, and it went bad. That we reached a stalemate in the North. You know, there were secret negotiations to give the Americans the North and give the Brits the South. Secret negotiations to do that. And just think for a moment what that would have done to our country music scene. And the Brits moved on the South, and they had a Southern strategy just like Republicans, and they took, you know, Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston, and they were rolling up the Carolinas, and they really were going to win until, of course, the Mountaineers came down at the Battle of Kings Mountain, but more importantly, until Thomas Paine wrote another pamphlet called The American Crisis. He'd come back from the front where Washington was losing. Washington was stringing people up because of the mutinies. He had no soldiers. He said they turned on the first glimmer of the bayonets. And he said, do something. And so Payne goes home realizing his musket was not as important as his pen. And he put it down in Philadelphia as Philadelphia was being threatened and marched on by troops. And there he wrote The American Crisis, saying, these are the times that try our souls. And of course, he said, these are the times that try men's souls. And I'll never forget, I did a reading a year ago at Writers Resist across the country. And I said, these are the times that try men's souls. And this young woman, a Gambian American, came up and she had her hijab on. And she said, dude, these are the times that try women's souls. And so we know these are the times that try our souls. Payne called on the nation to respond. That is no longer the time to be sunshine patriots, but to attack the British. December 19th, that was published. On December 23rd, George Washington read it to his troops in New Jersey. And the next day, the phone went off. And that was the sign to march. Thanks, bud. and the Americans finally defeated the British for the first time, crossing the Delaware. And we celebrate this wonderful thing, you know, this kind of mythological moment. And of course, the Revolution went on for even longer until we finally won at Yorktown. What's important about all this kind of talk, you know, not this war talk, because John Adams begrudgingly admitted, he said, oh, Tom Paine, he hated him because he was a commoner. He said, the history is going to ascribe the American Revolution to Tom Paine. He said it was Tom Paine's pen, not the sword of Washington, that won the American Revolution. It was the stories of the resistance that galvanized. It was the resistance that gave a backbone to the American people to actually do our American Revolution, more than any sword, more than any gun. That Tom Paine, a writer, the first person to ever inscribe those words, the United States of America, which he wrote first, is the person who gave us this fundamental credo that to be American, we have a patriotic duty to resist duplicitous authority whenever our democracy is under attack. That it is our patriotic duty to resist, not that we are attacking the White House, but we are defending the attacks from the White House. Not that we are attacking the police, but we are defending the attacks of the police on our young people and people of color. Not that we are attacking corporations, but we are defending the attacks of corporations on our workers and our economy. That this was the fundamental credo of what it meant to be an American: resistance. And this is what we're going to talk about a little bit today. I'm going to tone it down a little bit, not so dramatic. You guys are all looking really serious in the audience there. And it's Friday night, and we're here in front of Panini Panini. Io bistro, espresso, ma che perfetto per me, perché io volevo dire una cosa in italiano che è molto importante, perché pensiamo sempre che noi americani siamo numero uno, noi siamo americani, noi siamo numero uno, il paese più importante al mondo, Panini Panini, no, è America, America number one, no, siamo un paese eccezionale. And I'm thinking, what? What did that guy just say? And I'm thinking, we're an exceptional country? America? We're resistance? Oh, we're the only country that's ever had a revolution. We're the only country that's ever done resistance. We're the only country, you know, Thomas Paine, Donald Trump, his first speech in front of the UN, he had the audacity to go up and say, the first three words of the Constitution are fundamental, that we had the first constitution in the world. And I think he was referring to we the people. Not realizing that Panini, Panini, un po' nord di Panini, Panini is Corsica. And Corsica is this little island just outside of Sardinia, just off Italy. That Corsica had a constitution in 1755. That they finally won their independence from France. And the man who led the revolution there, he wanted to install his son, but his young son was part of the Enlightenment. And he's like, hey, dude, I don't want to be the king. I want to open it up to democracy. And so he creates what he calls a diet or the parliament, and every man had a right to vote. And it was an amazing system. They had rules and regulations, and there was no corruption. And the Corsicans, this amazing country, like so many other small communities, like the Black Forest in Germany and other communities, I'm sure even back in the Ukraine, Sergio, they were already working democracies on a small level. But Corsica wrote this constitution, Pasquale Paoli, if you've ever been to Paoli, Indiana. It's named after this Corsican revolutionary. That was pretty funny. You must be from Paoli, Indiana.
Close enough.
Close enough. They say Paoli.
Paoli. Oh. I'm sorry.
They're the headquarters of a certain white supremacist group.
Well, we need to go teach them a little history. Well, Pasquale Paoli doesn't quite work. He was a household name in America. The Sons of the Liberty leader in Boston named his son after him, Pasquale Paoli McKenzie. And there was a tavern in Philadelphia called the Paoli Tavern that was devastated by the British for a reason, because it was the symbol of resistance. that Benjamin Franklin said there's two revolutionary groups today. It's the Corsicans and the Americans fighting against the French and the Brits. That the Americans considered Pasquale Paoli a household name. He was as important as George Washington. And this is these amazing stories of resistance that we often forget. And I have no idea why I even brought it up other than Panini across the street. So sorry for that little interlude, but it's Friday night. Today with Trump, we think it's so dark. We think of immigration rights. We think of lesbian and gay rights and transgender rights. We think of what's happening with immigration rights and the separation of families. We think of civil rights and what's happening in our community, that my son has a 1 in 10 chance of being incarcerated and brutalized by the police compared to his best friend who's an African American. And we think of climate change, that we are in the record heat wave of July, that this is the hottest non-Nino that we've followed the last 3 years that were record years, that irreversible damage is going on, that we talk about the Circus Maximus coming out of Washington, but the truth is that 76 major environmental protection laws have been reversed. And we understand that here in the Midwest, where I'm from, with coal mining, that you can now dump against the Clean Water Act within the waterways. And this is dumping discharges of lead and selenium and arsenic. That these are dark moments. And in every one of those issues that I've just mentioned, though, we have fought before in the States. And we have won. And what I tried to do with this book, which is available for $24.99, is to show how we've had this continuum. This, I call it the arc of resistance. And how we bend toward that arc of resistance when we go through these cycles, when there is this duplicitous authority that attacks us, this fundamental credo, that it's never a majority, it's a minority, it's a small group of people. It's 25 people on the street of Franklin in Michigan City, Indiana, who realize they play the role as a catalyst on these issues. And so I'm going to look at a few moments in how we define resistance. So what is resistance? You know, that was the hardest thing. And resistance, what is resistance? Suddenly, after Trump got elected, we saw resistance everywhere, right? And I saw a headline, Google is going to sponsor the resistance, and Starbucks is going to give discounts for the resistance, you know? And then there's one of those Kardashian gals, you know, who was going to have a bottle of Pepsi Cola, and she's like a rebel without a cause, and they're making an ad, and I don't really know where she is, and it's just like a lot of cool, hip-looking people, and she's part of the resistance, and she gives a Coke, or no, Pepsi, God forbid, to a cop. And the resistance wasn't having that. Thank God. And even Hillary was part of the resistance. And there was this... There was this moment that, wow, we have a resistance. And I was worried that if, you know, if we don't root this thing, it's going to blow away like a tumbleweed when we get fatigued, you know, and we can't take it anymore. Not realizing that people have been resisting for 500 years in the indigenous communities, that since the first imprint of an English company, and we remember that our country was not founded by English people, it was founded by an English company. That the English James Company came over, and in 1619, they began to colonize, and within days of them being there, there was a work strike by Polish immigrant workers who were not given the same rights as the English. And within days of the first colony in America, there was a resistance shutdown of workers, Poles, and they won the right to vote. And then 20 Africans were dumped by the Portuguese and enslaved, including Angelo, who began the resistance movements of Africans to be African Americans. And of course, as we know, within two years, the Potawatomi destroyed Jamestown, and the Native American resistance continued until today in Standing Rock. That what is resistance? How do we get it deeper? How do we seed resistance in the way that Thomas Paine talked about it? That was my struggle with this book, is how do we look at our cultures and the history, this amazing history, and I'm confronted with fellow people who are in the trenches saying, hey, are you resisting the system, or are we the system? And how do you, are you even using resistance right? And why are you using American? We're against the American system, or maybe we're not American system, and whose American system are you talking about? And how do we decide who's we the people other than the 55 white men who signed that Declaration of Independence? And did you know that at the end of the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock, who was really good at those declarations, there was a name below John Hancock, did you know? It was Catherine Goddard, publisher, Baltimore. That it was a woman, only a woman, a printer in Baltimore, who had the courage to put her name and the return address of the resistance on the official Declaration of Independence. Catherine Goddard, Baltimore, come and get me. Incredible courage of the women. How do we talk about we the people? And so the first thing I talk about is resistance to me is reclaiming the commons. It's reclaiming who we are, the people, is beyond electoral politics. Yeah, we voted. Yeah, someone voted for this guy. But we still have the right to go into the street. We still have a right to our story. We still have a right to frame the narrative the way we the people want to. And this includes someone like William Apus. Sorry, it's taking a long time to get you up here again.
Okay.
You know.
How inhuman.
I'm not done yet, though.
Oh.
You're saying
how inhuman.
And how inhuman it took me so long to get you up here. All right. Are you taking it a little seriously, this role?
Oh, yeah. He's a serious guy.
So William Apus, look at him. He was this Pequot Indian. And there was this hipster, you know, with these, the hipsters have these really bad beards because they can't grow mustaches. And he's in 1833 and he's reading the newspaper. Yours is okay, and this hipster can't believe what he's reading. He's like, man, there's this cat down in Mashpee on Cape Cod who is in jail. And he's a Pequot Indian. And he had done this amazing declaration where the Mashpee tribe had basically said, hey, we're going to do on July 4th the Declaration of Independence because we're still here. The Native Americans weren't all slaughtered. And we want the rights to our area in Cape Cod. And, of course, it was amazing. He wrote this beautiful declaration, and they took it to the Massachusetts legislature, and they said, okay, you can do that. And so they went back thinking, oh, my God, we just won this Declaration of Independence pretty easily. And yet white people came to cut down their trees. And that's what they're trying to protect, because it's always the natural resource that the white people are after. And they came in and began to cut it down. And William Apus confronted it, this amazing Pequot Indian who had become a Methodist preacher and a circuit rider. And he wrote these beautiful books. One was a very romanticized idea of called Son of the Forest, but saying there is another story here you need to know. And when he began to stop the white people from cutting down the forest in 1833, they threw him into prison for inciting a riot. And Apus said, you can imprison me for as long as you want. You can whip me, you can be as cruel as you want, but my conscience is clean that it is my duty to go to prison to resist. And this young hipster in 1833 couldn't believe it. He's reading it. His name is Henry David Thoreau at Harvard University. And Thoreau's thinking, wow, it's amazing. This disobedience is going on, this nonviolent disobedience. And, of course, 15 years later, Thoreau would write his masterpiece of civil disobedience about not paying his taxes for the Mexican War. And we don't know, of course, that Thoreau secretly hid the fugitives of John Brown, that he was an incredible radical, that he blended this idea of the eco with social justice, this intersection that Thoreau was talking about in the 1840s goes back to a Native American. And William Apus, after he's released from prison, goes back and begins to speak again on stage, telling stories of an American resistance that even predated George Washington. Someone, he said, we had to know if we want to understand we, the people.
See, that makes what I'm going to read a little bit more special, right? Okay. How inhuman it was in those wretches to come into a country where nature shone in beauty, spreading her wings over the vast continent, sheltering beneath her shades those natural sons of an almighty being, that shone in grandeur and luster like the stars of the first magnitude in the heavenly world, whose virtues far surpass their more enlightened foes. Notwithstanding their pretended zeal for religion and virtue, how they come to go to work to enslave a free people and call it religion is beyond the power of my imagination and outstrips the revelation of God's word. Assemble all nations together in your imagination, and then let the whites be seated among them. And then let us look for the whites, and I doubt not it would be hard finding them. For to the rest of the nations, they are still but a handful. Now, suppose the skins were put together and each skin had its national crimes written upon it. Which skin do you think would have the greatest? I will ask one question more. Can you charge the Indians of robbing a nation almost of their whole continent? And murdering their women and children and then depriving the remainder of their lawful rights that nature and God require them to have? And to cap the climax, rob another nation to till their grounds and welter out their days under the lash with hunger and fatigue under the scorching rays of the burning sun. I would ask you if you would like to be disenfranchised from all your rights. Merely because your skin is white and for no other crime. I say then that a different course must be pursued, and different laws must be enacted, and all men must operate under one general law. Invoking Metacont, King Philip, whose name by English apes grafted memory into the reality of the times, give the Indians their rights, and you may be assured war will cease.
The war he was talking about was the war of what he called white savages. William Apis stunned Boston. He stunned the abolitionist community. He forced them to look at many liberal communities who wanted to defend the Cherokee because they were so far away, who wanted to talk about abolition because it was slavery was in the South, but didn't want to face the injustice that was happening at home. And yet he fundamentally changed how we look at civil disobedience. His ideas go on to influence really the rest of our country. It was an incredible, incredible story of this man who saw resistance not only as an act of civil disobedience, but reclaiming the public commons. And we have so, so many examples of that. Another one would be this amazing woman named Marie Ecuy, who came from the land of Panini. This Italian immigrant who 100 years after William Apis is finding herself in Portland, taking on World War I and not realizing that almost the majority of Southern males were resisting and fleeing into the hills, including both of my grandfathers, not wanting to fight World War I, an unjust war. That there was this new movement afoot to say, hey, we don't actually have to go along with what's going on, these profiteers who are making money off of this war, that we can do something else. And of course, Marie Ecuy was someone who was legendary. She was in Portland. Everyone knew her because she ran the most important health clinic. She worked on an abortion. She worked on contraceptives. And she was an open lesbian who had a wife and didn't hide it. 1918, we passed the Sedition Act saying anyone who goes against the war will be imprisoned. And of course, they rounded up a little less than 2,000 people. On the same day, they arrest this little boy from Terre Haute named Eugene Debs and put him into jail, who becomes the celebrated socialist leader. They also arrest Marie Ecuy. And they go after her for a different reason. They say she is a weird woman, as a code word for someone who's an open lesbian. That how dare a woman defy the system? How dare a woman scale up a post and put up flags and banners? How dare a woman block traffic? How dare a woman go against the war machine? And she was put in jail in 1920, after the war ended. In fact, 6 weeks after women win the right to vote, Maria Eckrey goes to prison with her resistance. And she once again defines who we are as Americans, taking down that Sedition Act.
The Sedition Act. I'm going to move this down. I think. Can you hear me? I'm short. I'm sorry. Thanks. To write, print, utter, or publish, or cause it to be done, or assist in it, any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government of the United States, or either House of Congress or the President. This was now a crime, warranting imprisonment for journalists and all others. Adams did not stop with the press. Congress passed an Alien Friends Act to grant the President the power to deport anyone he deemed dangerous. Marie Eckrey. Oh, it's very easy to attend a civic lunch, listen to a number of complimentary speeches from well-mannered and admiring people, while you wear your best clothes and play the part of a hero, she told an interviewer. But to go out and mount it on a soapbox and declare war against the organized forces of capitalism is quite a different number. The task of veering public opinion was never an easy one. A month after the war came to an end in 1918, Eckrey was convicted for sedition in Oregon court by a judge who ruled she did not keep quiet. Most observers saw the prosecutor's case as politically motivated. "Fears I have been hounded in this town," Eckrey said when the guilty decision was announced. In appealing her case in the Ninth Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court, Eckrey's defense team called out the attacks by the prosecution on her private moral characters as a lesbian. On October 17, 1920, 2 months after women gained the right to vote with the ratification of the 19th Amendment, Eckrey entered the San Quentin prison to serve a one-year term. "I'm going to prison smiling," the Portland newspapers reported Eckrey stating, "but I am not through. I shall keep on fighting until I die." Eckrey, who remained a fixture of resistance until her death in 1952, put it best, "I'm going to speak when and where I wish," she had said at the one of her rallies in Portland. "No man will stop me."
Thank you. So the Sedition Act, think about it. You know, we have a president today. You know, it's amazing to see Ivanka say that she really didn't think the journalists are the enemy of the people. And then she giggled. And we talk about enemy of the people. And of course, you know, Trump had his amazing rally yesterday in Pennsylvania where they're screaming and taunting the media. And we're just waiting for something to happen. And I'm wondering, what do you mean we're waiting? Five of our journalist colleagues were gunned down just 2 months ago in Maryland and killed. That the Sedition Act that put Marie Eckrey into jail goes back to John Adams. Once again, that same John Adams who didn't really like Tom Paine, who really didn't like black people, didn't like dissent. John Adams was this amazing character. He wanted to be called His Highness instead of His President. He and Alexander Hamilton, this young cat who was about 200 years too early before his Broadway debut, he said, "Hey, there's the few and there's the many. And it's the few that should control the country." That they believed in an aristocracy. And so the newspapers began to go after them and actually found out that John Adams had been colluding with our former enemy in the elections. Can you imagine if any president ever did that? That England had given $800,000 to mess and collude in our elections of 1796. And the newspapers reported this. And Adams was outraged that they found out. He was outraged that they reported the fact that they appointed his daughter Ivanka to be ambassador in Berlin and his son-in-law, and that he was using family members in the government. And he didn't like this kind of dissent. And there was these amazing newspapers, and from a woman, Anne Greenleaf in New York, to Aurora, this amazing newspaper in Philadelphia, of Benjamin Franklin's grandson. And they passed that Sedition Act. To write, to print, to publish, to say anything against the president or the Congress was against the law. And of course, Trump has even taken it one step further. He's like, why don't we do that and be able to sue them for libel? Because he always wants to make money as well. And the journalist didn't just sit back. The journalist didn't just walk out of a press conference. The journalist didn't just go on to Twitter. Oh, me. The journalist confronted them and led the resistance. The next day, there was the Constitution on one side of the front page, and there was a sedition on the act, and they said, either it's petition or resistance, in the words of Thomas Paine. And they began to muckrake even more and to go after them, and they imprisoned them. The first person who was imprisoned was a congressman from Vermont, because it's always some quirky congressman in Vermont giving us a hard time. His name was Matthew Lyons. You guys are doing pretty good on the jokes, but... Matthew Lyons was this incredible journalist congressman in Vermont. He had this great newspaper. It was called The Scourge of Aristocracy. I thought that would be a great name for a paper today. And he wrote that Adams was obsessed with self-adulation, and they put him in prison for that. And Lyons actually had to run for Congress from jail, and he got reelected, which was amazing. And they another and another and another, and the journalists like Bache in Philadelphia began to be imprisoned. Then he was released, and he died from yellow fever. And another man, a young immigrant from Ireland, but in fact he wasn't an immigrant. He was born in the States and then brought back to Ireland. His name was William DeWayne. He took up the cause, and he played this cat and mouse game. And meanwhile, there was this incredible movement of journalists in Virginia and Kentucky working with Jefferson and Madison. And Thomas Jefferson said, hey, this is the reign of witches. I can't believe what has happened to our country. And he said, it was only because of the journalists we have stopped this rapid march toward monarchy. And the journalists, even when they were imprisoned, continued to resist and fight. They passed this covenant. And of course, within 2 years, Adams was thrown out in the election and Jefferson won. And the Sedition Act was thrown out. Jefferson said, if it hadn't been for the journalists, we have no idea what would have happened to America because they joined the resistance. And yet 100 years later, we're passing that same Sedition Act to Marie Ecuy for the same reason she's speaking out, thinking 100 years later is today, and what is going to happen to us when enemy of the people is no longer a tweet but becomes a law? Where are we going to be in terms of supporting our journalists, and what role are the journalists going to play? It's really one of our big questions. The next thing I want to talk about is how resistance serves as a truth and reconciliation commission that we have lacked terribly in this country. In Greensboro, North Carolina, after the riots in the 70s, they tried to bring the communities together and have a truth and reconciliation commission. And we know it mostly, of course, because of what either happened in South Africa or what happened in Sri Lanka. But in South Africa, after apartheid was finally brought down, you know, the ANC, the African National Congress, was able to have a truth and reconciliation commission that people came up and admitted their crimes. And I find that resistance plays that role, that when we include other voices, people who've been part of this public comments who have resisted against this kind of overreach, we begin to get the real truth. And we begin to reconcile. Someone like Maria Stuart, this amazing woman, also in the 1830s of Boston. She had a column in William Lloyd Garrison's newspaper. It was called The Ladies' Corner, and that's why everyone wanted to buy his abolitionist newspaper. It was not because of his writings, but it was because of this African-American feminist in 1830s. She had done well financially because she was married to a dock worker. And of course, as we know, the black sailors were famous in Boston, that Moby Dick is based on the character of an African-American. And her husband died, but she was still there trying to make ends meet, and she would write these stories. But more importantly, she called out the issue of white supremacy in the 1830s and spoke to white audiences. And her story of resistance is vital to understanding today how already this continuum of seeking some truth and reconciliation had already been seeded 200 years ago with Maria Stuart.
Like King Solomon, who put neither nor Neil, sorry, who put neither wow, who put neither nail or hammer to the temple, yet received the praise, so also have the white Americans gained themselves a name, like the names of the great men that are in the earth. While in reality, we have been their principal foundation and support. We have pursued the shadow. They have obtained the substance. We have performed the labor. They have received the profits. We have planted the vines. They have eaten the fruits of them. What if I am a woman? Is not the God of ancient times the God of these modern days? Stuart continued. Did he not raise up Deborah to be a mother and a judge in Israel? Did not Queen Esther say the lies of the Jews? And Mary Magdalene first declare the resurrection of Christ from the dead? O woman, woman, upon you I call. For upon your exertions almost depends whether the rising generation shall be anything more than we have or not. Women have to take the next move as resistors of an unwarranted prejudice. Sue for your rights and privileges. Know the reason that you cannot attain them. Weary them with your importunities. I can but die for expressing my sentiments, and I am as willing to die by the sword as the pestilence. Look at the suffering of Greeks. Their proud souls revolted at the idea of serving a tyrannic nation, who were no better than themselves, and perhaps not so good. They made a mighty effort and arose. Their souls were knit together in the holy bonds of love and union. They were united and came off as victorious. Look at the French in the late Revolution. No traitors amongst them to expose their plans to the crowned heads of Europe. Liberty or death was their cry. And the Haitians, though they have not been acknowledged yet as a nation, yet have the firmness of character and independence of spirit, have been greatly admired and highly applauded. Look at the Poles, a feeble people. They rose against 300,000 mighty men of Russia, and though they did not gain the conquest, yet they obtained name of gallant Poles.
I just want to spend one more minute on the abolitionist movement. I struggle with it in my book, which is available here. Do we have books here tonight or not? Were we able to get them?
I don't have. We never received yet.
Okay. No problem.
Actually, we've got the box downstairs, and we're selling 15 manuals.
Okay, there you go. All right, there you go. Yeah, and it cut me. Now, and you, look at this guy. He's already walking over to get one. You know, that's a great idea. Thank you.
You guys are a hearty audience. You know, obviously I got 200 years of Baptist revivals in me, and it's hot and sweaty, and we're used to this stuff down in the South, but for you guys to sit in here and sweat through this history is really great. Appreciate that.
They sweated for us. We
sweat for them. There you go. That's great. This fundamental credo, that it's our patriotic duty to resist duplicitous authority. This idea that civil disobedience in all forms of resistance reclaims the public commons, that is beyond election. That we can serve as a truth and reconciliation commission and begin to heal the wounds of our country. These are all part of our resistance. We have one more to talk about, but I do feel like I got to grapple a little bit with the abolitionist movement. Because it's a movement that involved white and black leadership that I feel is very apropos to what's happening to the region. The abolitionist movement, of course, was led by people like William Lloyd Garrison, all these great men with three names. And the struggle was that white people should lead it. Until people like Martin Delaney came out of Pittsburgh saying, no, black people should lead this movement, and you really need to step aside. And Frederick Douglass saying, well, let's accommodate both sides here. And people like Maria Stewart saying, all you men should step aside. It should be women. And that same kind of issue we have today within our movements, that it's never a pretty scene, that there's many contradictions, there's many conflicts, there's many, you know, we talk about intersection, but I think intersections are often the scenes of a lot of car crashes. And how do we begin to understand who is going to define this story? And of course, the truth is we all define the story. That everybody has their own vision of what the resistance is. And two people that really defined it in the abolitionist movement, of course, was Frederick Douglass, who is amazing. But Frederick Douglass also struggling with trying to negotiate the white leadership of the abolitionist movement, trying to negotiate the political parties, trying to negotiate William Lloyd Garrison, who said, I don't even want to vote. I want non-resistance. And then there was Henry Highland Garnett, who we don't talk about. This other amazing preacher who, just like Frederick Douglass, had come out of slavery in Maryland, who understood that you are not going to stop slavery through peaceful resistance. And he felt that was the language of the white abolitionist. Henry Highland was this, Garnett was this amazing spellbinding speaker who clashed on stage constantly with Frederick Douglass, who was saying, hey, you know, we have to accommodate, we have to integrate. And of course, Delaney saying, no, we got to be black nationalists. And then here's Garnett saying, no, we got to be leading an armed struggle. In 1851, the nation was spellbound because in Pennsylvania, just outside Carlisle, a group of African Americans who had escaped from Maryland set up a farming community. And the slave owner had come in from Maryland because of the Fugitive Slave Act, which was the quite possibly the worst legislation ever passed in the history of our Congress, supported by Lincoln, that gave any Southerner slave owner the right to go and get anybody he declared was his property without showing any evidence. And this unleashed mayhem on the border states because people were going up and snatching all sorts of free African Americans. And a man named Gorsuch, funny enough, same name as our new Supreme Court justice, I'm sure totally not related, came into Maryland, crossed into Maryland, going after some enslaved African Americans who had liberated themselves. He goes into Pennsylvania, and there is a man named Charles Parker, who was the hero of Garnett, because Parker confronted Gorsuch with weapons and shot them down. And it was an amazing story for the nation that for the first time, African Americans had taken up weapons to defend themselves under the Fugitive Slave Act. And it had such a rippling effect that suddenly the Fugitive Slave Act was paralyzed, and there were very few acts afterwards. And it became one of this incredible cases. The Parker escaped, and he actually met up with Douglass, who became part of the armed struggle. And Parker eventually went into Canada, where he stayed for many years. He wrote an amazing piece in the Atlantic Monthly about what he did and the courage it took to take up weapons and why he felt it was the last resort. But we tend to forget that the Emancipation Proclamation only freed enslaved Americans south of the Mason-Dixon line, that it was, in fact, years later that we stopped the Fugitive Slave Act. And it wasn't because of Lincoln, but it was because of this armed resistance. And that was the problem between Douglass and Garnett. Garnett, in 1843, came to a crowd in Buffalo, and he was going to give a speech, and they tried to shut him down, and they tried to pull him off the stage, and William Lloyd Garrison didn't want anyone to cover it, and they knew what he was going to do. He was going to electrify the crowd and tell them they had to begin the armed resistance. And he had an amazing message he was going to deliver.
Resist! Resist! Let your motto be resistance. Resistance! Resistance! No oppressed people have ever secured their liberty without resistance. What kind of resistance you had make better. You must decide by circumstances that surround you and according to the suggestion of expediency. Brethren, I do.
Our last part we're going to talk about is cities of resistance. Have I finished with you guys?
I'm Benjamin.
Benjamin Page? Okay. We'll go ahead and skip that. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to just conclude with this. Unless you guys want to just improvise some character.
Resist! Oh.
These guys, man. Cities of Resistance is my last chapter. I began to say that we go back to Thomas Paine, it wasn't all protest. He said, we have it in our power to reinvent the world. He said, to become Americans, we've been transformed. That we try to put away our prejudice. But more importantly, we don't have to copy other systems. That we have the opportunity to create our own system. And that included economics. Thomas Paine is the first person to ever write about workers' rights, about creating a social welfare system, about agrarian justice. And he saw the United States grappling, which ultimately would become, obviously, a capitalist powerhouse. And saying, once again, we have it in our power to reinvent the world, that resistance is an agency of renewal. It's not a tearing down of a system, it's giving birth to a new system. I wrote this book for really one major reason. My 12-year-old son came to me after Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. And my kid came up to me and he said, hey, Daddy, is there any hope? And you know, you can't be glib to a 12-year-old. You can't just say, oh, yeah, everything's going to be fine and go play and recycle your pop bottle. You got to tell them the truth. And I couldn't give him a lecture on climate change because my little 12-year-old kid understands that. He, of course, coming from our background, he's been in strip mines. He's been in mines. He's been with coal miners. He knows that tonight 3 coal miners will die daily from black lung disease, a disease we diagnosed in 1831. My son also knows the power of solar panels on his grandparents' house and our house, and he knows it doesn't take rocket science to do that. Is there hope, Daddy? And I really didn't know what to say to him. I couldn't just launch into a sermon. And I wanted to go back to 2 things. One was I said, hey, you know, I got to tell you a story. Once your daddy was in jail, I was in jail in 1985, and we had blockaded the doors of the South African embassy. Because we had a president then, you know, his name was President Reagan, who was just as bad as Trump to us. And he refused to go and set sanctions against apartheid. In South Africa, he called Nelson Mandela a communist agent. And the Congress didn't have the backbone to pass sanctions until Ron Dellums, who we just lost last week, from Berkeley, pushed through a bill that finally won. And for 414 days, we blockaded the front doors of the South African embassy. A sustained civil disobedience. Not one of these, hey, everybody, we're going to get arrested on Saturday and then we go party on Saturday night. It was sustained. Every day a different group took their time. And there I was sitting in jail and I was 21 and I was thinking, you know, Panini, this is ridiculous. It's a joke. Well, you know, we're not changing anything just because we're getting arrested today. And I said, it's hopeless. And the guy sitting next to me in the jail cell was someone I had been working for in New York City. His name was William Sloan Coffin. Another one of those cats with 3 names, very important. And he, of course, was the great theologian, the civil rights activist. He had been famous for his anti-Vietnam activism. He had an amazing past because in World War II, he's a secret agent. He actually founded the CIA, and then he had his road to Damascus and came out a flaming liberal after he went to the divinity school. And what people didn't realize is that Coffin was not just a great theologian. He was the first white preacher to get arrested on the freedom rides in Alabama in 1961. And he came down in Alabama. They were pulled off the buses and beaten up. And Coffin was this big, tough guy, and he was pissed off, and he was ready to fight back, and the young African-Americans told him, you know, calm down. It's not why we're doing this. They went to jail, and he said in jail he was restless, and a young African-American told him, hey, we're in it for the long haul. This is going to take a long time. We've been in it for a long time. That if you're hopeless, hopelessness adapts. But if you're with us, hope resists. And that's what I wanted to tell my son is hope resists. That we can't adapt. That right now we have a system we call adaptation, that we hear all the environmentalists talking about adaptation. Now we're going to set up our town because of climate change to adaptation. But if you're adapting to a failed system, it's not adaptation, it's failure. And how do we begin to change the framing of this? How do we re-envision this? How do we have it in our hands to reinvent the world? To me, you go to places like Gary, Indiana. You go to the corner of 7th Avenue and Carolina, where there's an abandoned lot where an orchard is growing now, and four hoop houses, and there's solar panels on the Progressive Church, and there's this community that's realizing they're going to regenerate what they're producing. That they're no longer going to be part of this linear economy, this same kind of environmental destruction that we've had for years. And of course, the Paul Revere of ecology, Barry Commoner in 1971, was right there on the cover of Time magazine saying, hey folks, it's pretty clear you're not going to be able to sustain capitalism and have an environmental future. That was the message of Earth Month. The thing got diluted. That how do we begin to struggle with the reality that we've set up an economic industrial system that simply is no longer compatible with the planet resources? And that is what I'm seeing in Gary, you know, on 7th and Carolina. If you haven't been there, you should go there, because this is the future. This is the city of resistance. That in fact, if 70% of our carbon footprint is coming from the cities, you know, it doesn't matter if Trump has pulled out of the Paris Climate Summit, which was non-binding anyway. The burden is on the cities, like Michigan City and in Gary and Chicago and New York and all these major cities, to take the lead to reverse what we're doing. Not to do better, not to be sustainable, because we know nothing is sustainable. That's a greenwashing word. But to create a regenerative economy and a regenerative society that realizes anything we produce or consume, we have to produce in a circular way. And so my last chapter looks at that. How do we see resistance today in a truly unique vision and go beyond just the fact that we have to stop coal-fired plants, we have to stop this, we have to stop that, but how do we also, as we're stopping and blocking and continuing this great role of civil disobedience, these amazing people, when I did my reading in Boston just last week, I had all these people come from Roxbury who had blocked a natural gas pipeline and stopped the fracking gas that was coming to Boston. And they took it to court, and they, believe it or not, they won their case on the climate change necessity defense, that the judge let them off and didn't convict them because they had the necessity defense of climate change that forced them to do this. But that's where we're at now. But at the same time we're doing that, we're having people who are creating cities of resistance. And this is where I'm going to end. I see another community in Las Vegas, and I'm thinking, what other place could epitomize everything that has gone wrong in the world than Las Vegas? And Las Vegas is great when you go at night, you know, and in the deserts, it's 122 degrees this week in Death Valley, and you have a city that has declared they're going to be 100% renewable. And that the municipal utilities are already moving toward renewable energy. And you're thinking, oh, wait a minute, you have this chaos of consumption, this chaos of madness, and just the madness, of course, of Vegas and gambling and corruption. And there in Vegas, I went to a little school, and there was a woman named Juliana who had worked with me on immigrant rights, and she had this amazing story about how she said, Jeff, you saw how Trump wants to do the travel ban on Muslims, but did you see what the Supreme Court said? They said, you know, there's also the Korematsu case, and that we know Korematsu because she was from Arizona, and she said Korematsu was a young Japanese American. Let's just say he was a young American who happened to come from Japanese ancestry, and he resisted. He refused to go into the camps in 1943 when FDR passed the military order, and eventually he was arrested on the streets of Oakland with his girlfriend, who was an Italian, and they put him into jail, and he took his case all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he lost. But he knew he was right, that there was no constitutional reason that we were allowed to imprison Americans just because they came from Japanese ancestry. 110,000 people imprisoned. And I'm thinking back to, you know, when I was in Arizona on my book tour, the First Lady came, and of course she was there to kind of do this fake tour of the internment camps now for Mexicans and other undocumented people. And I'm thinking of another First Lady in 1943. Eleanor Roosevelt comes to Arizona to see the Japanese internment camps, and she's heard about the Korematsu case, and she's mad at FDR, and against his wishes, And I'm not sure Melania did this, but against his wishes, Eleanor Roosevelt actually calls for the camps to shut down. And she said, we have to undo the mistakes of the past. And that is exactly what Thomas Jefferson said in 1801, his first address to Congress. We have to undo the mistakes of our immigration policy. And here was Juliana in Las Vegas, this amazing teacher, and she's talking about immigrant rights, and she's saying, do you understand what I'm teaching? I have an outdoor school, we have our own garden, and these kids are learning outdoors, and they're learning to create a regenerative city as immigrants. And I'm seeing this little place like Gary, Indiana, like Michigan City, like so many places across the country have these amazing movements, like this place, like Park, you know? This is really not just a venue, it's not just a meeting place, but it's a vibrant living room of people who are part of this movement, who are the catalyst, who are really, at the end of the day, going to change our nation. And that, to me, is resistance. And that's the resistance I really wanted to talk about. That was the story I wanted to tell my son. That, yeah, it's dark times. But we've been in these dark times. And there's these unsung heroes who we never will know about. That there's not one monument to Thomas Paine in Washington, D.C. That the U.S. Capitol is full of statues of Confederates. And not one monument to the man who gave us the name the United States of America. But his story is still alive. And the question is, when you leave tonight with a copy of this book for $24.99 or $15.99 from Vince, the question is, how are you going to answer my son? What role in the resistance are you going to play? Is it going to be Henry Highland Garnett? Is it going to be Maria Stewart? Is it going to be Maria Equi? Is it going to be Benjamin Bache, the journalist? Is it going to be Crispus Attucks? Is it going to be Barry Commoner? You have to decide what is your role as a catalyst in what you're going to do in Michigan City. So thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming tonight. Big hand to Walter. And another big hand to Allison.